From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a look at some of the headlines at Consortium News with the editor-in-chief of that news outlet, Joe Loria. We'll start with Gareth Porter's piece, How the Department of Homeland Security Created a Deceptive Tale of Russian Hacking U.S. Voter Sites. And they sure as hell did, didn't they?
Well, this is a really extraordinary piece by Gareth Porter, and I'm so happy he allowed us to publish it. The overall view is that the allegations made by DHS and by Mueller as well in his indictment of the GRU agents, the military intelligence agents in Russia, for having hacked into the elections or trying to somehow disturb our wonderful democratic elections of 2016 is really right. A ruse, and that at least there's no evidence of this whatsoever yet. Plus, DHS, according to Gareth here, was really working towards its own institutional power. It was trying to get control of cyber security in the United States, trying to muscle its way in there. Of course, more money from the federal government, more authority. And it set up, it had contacted individual states, but they released a report in December of 2016, but they didn't give it to the states until sometime in May of 2017, where it explained all these efforts by Russia to hack into the databases of the election rolls of these states. And one by one, including some interviews that Eric did for this story, some very good interviews, he shows how states have rebuffed all those claims by the DHS. That in fact this had not happened, that they, in many instances, never, that there were hacking attempts, but that they were made into the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Environmental Protection Agency of the state, not the electoral rolls. Right. And the main point of this article is that the available evidence shows that most of these hacking or scanning attempts were actually done for commercial reasons, that they were taken they want people's IDs and personal information so they could sell them on the black market that's online, and that there's no way to connect this to the Russian government, and that they have not done that. And in fact, several of these secretaries of state of the various states that were informed complained first that all they got from the DHS was a phone call and a guy reading, you know, a script from the DHS saying that Russia has stolen, tried to, you know, hacked into your electoral rolls. When all of these secretaries of state pushed back and spoke either to other publications or their representative spoke to Gareth and said that they were able to prove that this was not Russia. So it's a really important piece. There's also something I added as editor, as my purview, is I added something that Gareth left out, which was an interesting case that the Wall Street Journal reported on. I don't like to often give the Wall Street Journal too much credit, but it deserves it in this case. They reported in December 2016 that the DHS was itself behind hacking attempts of Georgia's election database, that they admitted it, that they were probing it. So it's a boondoggle, the whole thing. This whole issue of the databases being hacked by Russia, Gareth Porter picks it apart piece by piece in a quite lengthy but extremely detailed and well-sourced an attributed piece for Consortium News that I urge all your listeners to read. I think you'll learn quite a lot about this entire issue because it's very comprehensive, this article.
And his work is like that, too. And this is a particularly good example of it. You know, if you take a look back, take a step back and take a look at the whole of the electoral system, our democratic elections, as they refer to it in the media. I live in the village of Ossining, New York, okay? It's population of 25,000, roughly. There are 22 election districts, voting districts in the village of Ossining. So you're talking roughly with 100% of everyone, including children, voting in an election. And it's more like 50% of the eligible voters, or about 50% of 75%. You would have about 1,000 people. So you've got 300, 400, 500 people at each polling place. They're open from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. And there are at least one team of 6 to 10 people there in each case. Now, up until the Help America Vote Act or whatever it was that put all our, a lot of our voting in black boxes. We used to have the mechanical machines here in New York. You would go in and you'd pull some levers and they would make impressions or ink on a piece of paper that's inside the machine. It would also increment little mechanical, talliers on the back of the machine. There were some ways to audit the machine from the opening to the close, physical inspection. They were definitely hackable, but not remotely. You had to physically go mess with the machine or else that was it if you were going to mess with the vote count. And in addition to that, everybody, you had a half dozen people there that were witnessing what happened, and the machines opening and closing were done in public. You could inspect it that way. Then we went to the machines. Now we have optical scan machines, and they keep the paper ballot. And so what they ought to be doing, I don't know if this is what they are doing, you get a total off the computer, which is networked, so it's hackable in one way or another, remotely. But you get a machine total, and then there are actual physical ballots, which are certainly able to be used as an audit trail. Let's physically count the votes. And again, this voting district where I vote at, 500 people vote there. So it's not a monumental task. This is something that has been replaced or never with the optical scans given in the U.S. over the last 10 years. Instead, you have these black box machines. And that ought to be the story. And instead, it's a picture of Boris Badenov in the basement of the Kremlin monkeying with voting machines in Kansas, via the internet.
We need to go back to paper ballots, Don. Yep. I mean, Germany is one of the most advanced technological countries, and they still use paper ballots, as most of the developing world does.
Yeah.
It's the only way to prevent any kind of tampering with the election result. I mean, to get away from technology, it's a disaster. I mean, I used those machines in New York. I grew up in New York City, of course, and I used those old machines, and they were perfectly okay. It's very, very disturbing. Now, this is about money, of course, people wanting, getting big government contracts to put these machines in, but we don't need them. And it leads to these kind of story that Gareth wrote, that there's attempts by, looks like, cyber criminals to get personal information from DMV and other things, and not necessarily the electoral rolls, as DHS falsely claimed. If we eliminated this, any kind of electronic system for voting, went back to paper ballots, we couldn't even begin to discuss this story. So that's the, and you're right to bring that up, that the electoral system itself and how we vote, what technology we use, is at the heart of this problem, because otherwise we wouldn't have this aspect of Russiagate.
Right. And then along those same lines, let's go back for a moment to where we had paper ballots, which, before the last set of voting machines, I don't know, going back 40, 50 years or whatever, that's what they did. It was a paper ballot. You stuck it in a box, literally. I have one. My grandfather left me one as, part of my legacy. And, there were abuses. The stuffing the ballot box came out of that mode of voting.
But if you had people from both parties
watching
the voting,
right? Then it wasn't possible to stuff it. It's empty when you start, and you see the people put them in. So, but now let's say you have that condition, and then some guys in DHS uniforms come in and say you can't be trusted to count the votes in your own district. We're going to do it for you. What does that feel like?
I mean, that could happen if they went back to paper ballots, but the whole thing is just asking for abuses, either by hackers or by government officials who want to spin that hack to be something other than it is, to aggrandize their own power,
right,
and again blame Russia for something that they may or may not have done. It looks like the Russian government, there's no evidence they were involved in any of these hacking. Certainly, there was never a charge that Russian government tampered with the election results. Obama made that clear in his final press conference. Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, when he announced his Mueller indictment in July of the GRU agents, made that clear. The indictment itself, if it's interesting, does not mention electoral laws.
Right.
In other words, in every indictment at the beginning, it says these are the laws that we're saying that these defendants broke.
Right.
And the electoral laws are not mentioned.
Right.
So if they tamper with our election, why aren't they being charged under U.S. election law?
Right, exactly.
That tells you something right there.
Exactly.
So the Russiagate thing is another thing that we covered in the second story we want to discuss, since we have a limited time, Don, and that was by Gene Rank, who is a former researcher and associate at the University of North Carolina. Now, Jean wrote a very delightful little piece about her trip to Florence, Italy.
Right.
In January, she happened to come upon Galileo's house, where he lived under house arrest for the remaining years of his life. And she had been earlier that day attending a conference on Russia and U.S. and Trump, etc. So she put two and two together and realized that what we're experiencing now is a kind of inquisition against a whole bunch of people. She names them, like Snowden and Manning, etc., who are being accused of somehow working with Russia to, again, undermine our democratic institutions. If we haven't done, our own plutocrats haven't done enough to destroy our democratic institutions, blame it on Russia to deflect attention from their own criminality or mistakes or their own repression of democracy in our country. And of course, they can't face that, and they won't change that.
Right.
So they want, the democratic elite establishment won't change its policies to go along with the progressive wing, but again, completely blames everything on Russia for why they lost. They have created a social unrest in this country, and like any tinpot dictator or any leader in the history of civilization, when you've abused your population and they start fighting back or they start piping up, you know, you have to blame a foreign power. That's what they've done. And that's all the U.S. Leadership is doing here, blaming a foreign power for problems they themselves created. So Jean wrote this very nice article in which she says, the title I gave it was, "The Sun Does Not Revolve Around the U.S." And that is, of course, a play on Galileo, and that the U.S. started to think that the universe revolved around itself around the around 1898, when the attack was made on the failing Spanish Empire, and the U.S. grabbed the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam and these other places. And the it led, of course, to this, all the way to this Russian mania in an attempt to undermine Russia. And so Jean goes through some recent publications that question the entire Russiagate narrative. It's well worth a read, short piece, but it gives another insight into this issue.
And she does take a look at some of the current literature, some of Mearsheimer's work, Richard Sakawa's work, you know, some others. And an interesting way that they tossed Solzhenitsyn aside after, you know, getting what they needed out of him for
exactly
all the time they sucked his blood.
Exactly. Yeah, the guy was consistent in his views, and that happened to take America into his orbit. And you start to criticize America, and then they forgot about this guy. He was no longer useful. As you said, they got what they needed out of him and threw him on the – we have a whole history of that, and even worse, like Saddam. They got what they needed out of him. And against Iran, Noriega, they got what they needed out of him.
Yeah, at least they didn't string up Solzhenitsyn, right?
Yeah. So Solzhenitsyn is a minor figure in the in this pattern of behavior where the U.S. uses up leaders, or in this case a writer, and then throws them out when they don't need them anymore and trashes them and kills them in the case of Saddam and murders and imprisons them in the case of Noriega.
And from here, I'd like to jump into Diana Johnstone's piece on the front page of ConsortiumNews.com, the real Russian interference in U.S. politics. And she says, basically, and this is someone that knows, that if Russia were trying to interfere in U.S. politics, it wouldn't be trying to change the system, but to get the U.S. to leave Russia alone, to stop trying to change Russia's system, which the U.S. has been working on for about 100 years now, 101 years.
Yes. That's about right. And in fact, she does identify Russian interference in U.S. politics, but it's not from what we're hearing from the mainstream media that it's the Russian government of Vladimir Putin. Right. It's, in fact, people like Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Yeah, right.
And then Bill Browder, who's American, but he worked to create this Magnitsky Act. So there are people who – and she makes an interesting point about a history of exiles or – from various countries, whether it be Cuba, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be Iraq.
Right, the compradors on the run. The compradors
lobby the Washington, you know, lobby everybody in Washington to come to overthrow their government and miraculously put themselves in power as well.
Right.
So here's a case of the Russians coming to the U.S. to get the Magnitsky Act and to do other things that will hurt Putin. So anti-Putin people are influencing American politics. That's what she's saying, not the Russian government.
Right.
It's a really fascinating and important piece.
Right. I mean, remember Shalabi, for example, from Iraq. That he was.
Perfect example. The Syrian exiles.
Right. Yeah, they got those too.
They're all set up here in Washington. They came up to the UN when I was based at the UN. I had many press conferences with them, and sometimes just pretty strong disagreements with them. They're selling a BS line that somehow they were democratic and that they represented, even if they were democratic, that the FSA, for example, Free Syrian Army, that and this exile group were in the vanguard and the majority of the rebellion against Bashar al-Assad, when in fact it was these jihadists that were backed by the U.S., by Saudi Arabia, by the other Gulf countries, by Turkey, but even by some European countries. These became, in short order, after the initial uprising, the main opposition and revolutionary group, if you can call them that, the group that wanted to overthrow Assad. That John Kerry himself admits in this leaked conversation he had with those kinds of Syrian exiles in New York in 2015, right, in which he says he knows why Russia intervened is because he wanted to stop ISIS from taking over Damascus. And instead, right, the U.S. was watching ISIS move on Damascus, and we were hoping it would get Assad to leave. So they were using ISIS. They helped create ISIS. Yeah. They were still using ISIS, and they were going to hope that it forced Assad to leave. Suppose it did. What would they have done then? Then go to war against ISIS? May have been too late. Right. So this piece is quite good because it shows how the real Russian interference in U.S. politics, and it's not the government of Putin, because we still don't have evidence of that. If it happens, I'm going to report it on conservative news.
Well, you know, you mentioned Khodorkovsky, okay? We're talking about, the Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is probably the best known, certainly the richest one of the so-called oligarchs, the people that looted the socialist economy and made huge personal fortunes. When Putin came to power, more or less, started to assemble something resembling a government back in around the year 2000. They started to look at these people that had taken control, particularly of strategic industries, and put it back in order like a normal nation state would have. And Khodorkovsky, who had stolen so much, he ran off with his checkbook and his bank books. Well, Khodorkovsky is now partners with the U.S. CIA, basically, with the Broadcast Board of Governors, in the various U.S. propaganda instruments around the world, like Radio Free Europe and such. Khodorkovsky is their business partner now. So talk
Khodorkovsky
about
meddling. Is a big asset for the U.S. in their attempts to undermine and remove Vladimir Putin, in my opinion. So he has become a hero to the Americans who aren't and Russians who are anti-Putin Russians. So he's quite a piece of work. I mean, he went to jail. Yep. He got his hands on Yukos, which now the Russian government has taken back to some extent. At least it's Putin went after these oligarchs and said, if you stay out of politics, I'll leave you alone. And many of them did not. Right. So he went after them.
Right.
And the issue of this Khodorkovsky and others getting the Americans to, and this Magnitsky Act is really key to this, is the way that Russians are interfering in U.S. politics, because to hurt Russia, that's the main issue.
Right. Yeah, and one of the things, Putin has said, stay out of politics. He also took a look at the strategic industries and said either, if you're going to operate it, you're going to operate it subordinate to the national interest of the country, or we will operate it that way. And
that's right.
And that's what that was the main breaking point on Yukos with Khodorkovsky and the Kremlin. We've got this one other story I want to get to, but I want to play a little more with the just the idea that was raised by Gareth about the whole condition that exists on the ground. See, we're coming into, as you know, I'm telling you nothing you don't know. We're coming into another election in 2018. It's being framed that basically this is going to be an opportunity to remove Trump. So it's in one way, this is going to be a referendum on whether or not to impeach Trump. Also, it's going to be a test. Is Putin really in control of the U.S. government or of the electoral system, or will we be able to get it back so that we can fix this, et cetera? That's how it's being framed. The same problems we've been complaining about, all of us that have been covering this stuff for, you know, a decade or two, exist with black box voting. You know, Ohio, Florida, you know, it wasn't hanging Chadskis when the 2000 election took place. You know, Arizona, there were a number of states where the machine totals that were announced in 2004 didn't make sense. We had districts in 2008 primaries in New York and Harlem that where Obama had no votes. We had a couple hundred thousand people purged from the voting rolls in New York City for the primaries in 2016, for the Democratic primary, etc. Voter caging, all the things that have been documented still exist in the United States, and they're going to still exist for this election. And the bugaboo is, as you've pointed out, Russia, if people are unhappy with the outcome.
Exactly right. They're setting it up so that if the Democrats don't win as many seats as they think they're going to win, that they can blame Russia. Russia did it. It's not their horrible policies. It's not that they won't try to address the needs of the American people, which are largely economic. No, no. It's because Russia has done it to them. And yes, you have very right to point out this is the real problem in our electoral system. And Greg Palast, as you well know, has done the best work on this to expose things like cross-check and caging and all this stuff that happened in the last election. And Greg also pooh-poohs Russia's interference. He's saying that it's these Russian, mostly Republican-led cheating to get people. I mean, he started in 2000 election, the infamous 2000 presidential election, in which he discovered Governor Jeb Bush, brother of the Republican candidate, did to get mostly black people, Democratic voters, off the road voting rolls and shut down streets with barricades and put a lot of people who were not really felons, kicked them off. This is the crisis, and no one wants to talk about it. And the great mystery is, why don't the Democrats bring this up? Because it's mostly Republicans hurting Democrats. It's really a mystery.
You know, you have on the other side of it, their techniques that are employed by the Republicans. Generally, they try to suppress minority vote, urban vote, etc., places where the Democrats outpoll them generally. But the Democrats also have the games that they play that follow the same line, basically. And in each case, it's, you know, the theory behind the way they operate the electoral system in New York State, for example, where you have two commissioners in each jurisdiction, one a Republican, one a Democrat, nominally the two top vote getters in the gubernatorial election, but one a Republican, one a Democrat. The theory is that, you know, if you have two thieves watching each other, then none of them can steal anything because the other one will be busy trying to angle to steal it from them. It's, you know, the thieves will keep each other honest, basically. That's kind of the subtext to it. This system is inadequate to the task of government in the 21st century, and it seems that the application of technology to the problem is intended to exacerbate it rather than solve it.
No question about it. That's exactly right. It's a huge crisis that gets no attention. Your listeners could check out an excellent interview that Greg Palast did with Jimmy Dore last year, I believe. She goes through all of this. This is the issue that should be getting the attention, but you have to go to a comedy club comedian, as Dore refers to himself, to get some attention put on this issue. Yeah. It's a huge, huge problem. And again, the media is going to point towards Russia. And again, they have a ready-made excuse, the Democrats, if they fail in November.
That's too bad.
It's going to be Vladimir Putin again. Mm-mm-mm. It's pitiful.
All right, so let's go, meanwhile, to the fourth piece we're going to look at. And the big story over the weekend, the big story, quote-unquote.
Yeah.
The other side of John McCain, and that other side being the side that we all know, but posited against this media creature that's been, you know, wall-to-wall for the last 3, 4, 5 days. Is he a saint yet? I don't know. He's the noblest, fairest-minded, most honest, all of that nonsense we've been hearing. Max Blumenthal on that.
Yeah, first, we're really excited to have Max writing original stories for Conservative News. This was his first one.
It's a great one, too.
It happened. It is a great piece. It's the kind of stuff we want to publish and have a writer like Max on board, like Garrett. And I will give you a little sneak preview. Pepe Escobar is now writing for us as well, and I'm going to publish later tonight his first piece.
Ooh.
So we're getting some really high-powered, well-established writers writing originally for us. And this piece by Max was absolutely needed, of course. In fact, someone on Saturday night said, you got to find someone to write the real story about John McCain. And then Max contacted me, would you like to story about John McCain? So I was really pleased about that. Now, I was in a restaurant here in Alexandria, Virginia, where I live, and on the screen was, without the sound, was CNN, and I was just looking briefly at it, and I saw all these old childhood pictures of McCain and his pictures in the Navy and all of this stuff, and I knew what was going on. I did not have to listen, and that's all I saw of it. But you could, you just know that they were going to deify this man, who was one of the dirtiest, most violent and warmongers the U.S. has ever seen. That's my personal opinion. Now, the article doesn't call him a warmonger because we don't need to say that. We just lay out the facts. Let the reader come to their conclusion that John McCain has been working behind the scenes, but even openly, because he appears in photographs with these people, with the jihadists, with people in Latin America, with the some of the dirtiest, most violent people to pursue America's imperial interests. And this is what John McCain's all about. He is, of course, he came out of this military family where both his grandfather and his father were admirals. And he was captured and tortured, although a lot of our readers are questioning in their comments whether he was really tortured or not. But he came out of this with, it seems like, a maniacal desire to fight first communism. And Max brings up something I never knew about him, that McCain joined this group. I'm going to try to see. It's called
The World Anti-Communist League.
The World Anti-Communist League. In the 1980s. And then Max points out that in 1974, the guy, Jeffrey Stuart Smith, who founded the British chapter of this World Anti-Communist League, left it in 74, complaining that it was a collection of Nazis, fascists, anti-Semites, sellers of forgeries, vicious racialists, and corrupt self-seekers. It also has evolved with the anti-Semitic international. That's the group that John McCain joined. Is all, do any of those adjectives describe him? Maybe not the anti-Semite, but certainly a vicious... look, he's corrupt, and he was a self-seeker, and he was driven by this ideology of empire, and he went on his own to pursue American foreign policy, to drum up support and to get support in the Congress for these horrible groups around the world that are pursuing their own short-term interest to overthrow a government that would help America's overall geostrategic strategies. And John McCain was like the emissary of American empire, without question. And he is all of this that he did. And there's more that wasn't even mentioned in this piece, like this incident on the USS Forrestal, where it said that he wet-started his plane as a practical joke to the pilot behind him, and the fireball that came out.
130 set people.
Set off a missile, killed 100.
More than 100.
More than 100 U.S. sails. He was immediately taken off that ship, and the investigation was suppressed. Why? Because his father was an admiral.
And his grandfather. That's right.
Now, maybe he didn't do it, but we don't know. The fact we don't know is very suspicious what happened. And that wasn't even mentioned in this piece. What is mentioned in here is his role in America's foreign, imperial foreign policy, and the fact that none of this is even balanced in any way in the coverage, and that they're glorifying this guy is not about this guy. It's not about John McCain. It's about glorifying that policy.
You know,
that's what corporate media does.
What really gets me, look, let's see, aside from all the votes and the lobbying and everything else, to every war more or less since he hit Congress in the 1980s, he was palling around with death squads in Central America, Nazi. He was on the stage with actual Nazis in Ukraine only 4 years ago. And there are people that call themselves progressive crying tears over this guy.
Even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's the great hope now of progressives, and I was really thrilled that she won too, but she also praised him as a decent human being.
Right.
Now, if they're still clinging to the establishment and needing their approval, I really think these people, like, well, Ocasio, if you're going into government, clearly you're going to need the system's approval. They see the establishment as the only game in town. And they have to be part of it. They have to cater to it. They need to be told yes, and they want to move up in it, become well-known in it, and to obviously play the career game. And you have to totally reject what's going on. This is why I'm so happy to be running Conservative News, because it is an anti-establishment website without question, and I'm, I am employed to run this site, and I don't have to, for 1 second, kowtow to anything in the establishment. They are dead to me in a way. They are something we are criticizing, we're against, and we're trying to create something new.
That's right.
And you have to create something new. You can't cling to the old. You have to continually persist in developing a different point of view and a different hopefully organization. And this is not what people who call themselves progressive are doing when they still think the establishment is what they need to become part of or at least approved by.
Joe Luria, the editor-in-chief of Consortium News at consortiumnews.com. Thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure again. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.